Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So, good morning everybody, welcome. Yeah, as we said, day two. Request for or what June just chanted is actually a formal request for teachings, and it's a very beautiful way of beginning our day in the sense of making that formal request. And also it's a part of the tradition, as especially for monastics, we're actually not allowed to teach, and we can't just sort of go out and get on our soapbox in the middle of Victoria Inner Harbour and start sort of ranting dhamma at people. There's a tradition of that the Buddha set down that you don't teach unless you're asked to, and which is great. There, people show an interest, and you can respond to that interest rather than trying to drum up business or anything. the actual chant is from the story of the Buddha's awakening. What it is a recollection of the after the Buddha had, of course, he spent 6 years in austerities and practicing incredibly diligently, and realizing that this was not the way to awakening, and that in order to really awaken, realize truth, he's going to need to have a balance of the physical and mental, emotional well-being, and then that was a catalyst for him continuing his quest, and then realizing the full awakening. One of the realizations that came on his full awakening is nobody's going to be able to understand this. This is just too subtle, too much against the grain of what those in the ordinary human condition are going to be willing to really take on and understand. But it was a Brahma god, Brahma Sahampati, who's referenced in that chant, and who sort of sees that and comes and just has a feeling of, oh no, this is a disaster, and then says to the Buddha, there are beings with little dust in their eyes who will be able to understand this. And then that was the catalyst or the trigger for the Buddha to say, right, that kind of that heart of compassion arising out of that. There, yes, there are. Yes, that's true. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are, would be open to this. So then he determined to teach. But even then, he was newly awakened, and he spent time contemplating his practice, the truths that he had realized. And then when he determined to teach, it was okay, who would be ready and open for that? And then he thought that these, say, five ascetics that had practiced with him would be open to that. And so then, from the place of the Buddha's awakening to where he gave his first teaching, where these five ascetics were, I mean, it's like over 200 kilometers. And so there was a determination to teach. It wasn't sort of, okay, they're just around the corner, I'll see if they're interested. It was, he made that kind of commitment, investment, to walk through the Indian countryside and go to help them out. Along the way, of course, India is full of wandering ascetics and religious seekers, and so then somebody, one of these wandering ascetics, saw the Buddha and was sort of really struck by his demeanor. And you can imagine somebody who is, I mean, one, he's a warrior noble. He's, you know, fairly young. He's just newly awakened. There's probably some, yeah, charisma, kind of a radiance coming from him. And then asking, your demeanor is pleasant. Have you realized something? And you know, who's your teacher? And then the Buddha, I have no teacher. I've seen the truth. I've seen reality. I'm the first one to be awakened in the world. And I'm going to Benares to beat the drum of the deathless. And the wandering ascetics, whoa. well, good luck, venerable friend. And the Buddha continues on. He said, well, that didn't work. So by the time he got to Benares, then to meet with these five ascetics, that is when he gave his first teaching that's recorded, and Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. That laying out a structure of investigation, rather than having to believe in some proclamation, or believe in a person who's making some proclamation. It's sort of, here's a structure to investigate your own experience with. Here's a key that will open up that veil of delusion and ignorance that tends to cloud us all. And using the Four Noble Truths as that structure for to investigate, so that dukkha, cause of dukkha, cessation of dukkha, path leading to cessation of dukkha. And dukkha being, I mean, it's a very nuanced word it's oftentimes translated as suffering. So suffering causes suffering, cessation of suffering, path leading to cessation of suffering. But that's only a part of the picture, and sort of that the quality of, say, yeah, dissatisfaction, discontent, or unsatisfactoriness, stress, any kind of nuance of something that doesn't quite gel, doesn't quite harmonize, doesn't quite feel right. Other than dukkha. The Buddha used an ancient word, like pre, because sometimes the Buddha actually made up his own words for some of the concepts he was trying to convey, or took a word and used it in a slightly different way. The word dukkha is it was something that everybody understood in India at the time. It's a very old root, and so that in the ancient Indian languages, just the prefix tu is something not good. just doesn't work. It's unpleasant. It's uncomfortable. It's stressful. So is good. That's happy. Sukha is happiness. Happiness, well-being, delight, that sense of comfort, ease is sukha. And ka is part of the word, is an in ancient India, like pre-Buddhist, was a horse culture with wagons, chariots. Ka was where the axle fits into the wheel for the so like dukkha is when the wheel doesn't go smoothly. It's kind of either it's tight and uncomfortable, or it's loose and sloppy, or it's uneven and bumpy, and that's dukkha. That's what the Buddha's pointing to, and that's where the sense of the roots of the word dukkha. And it was when I heard that explanation, one of the things that came up was my own growing up in northern Manitoba, and sometimes you get, very cold spells, and your tires, the air contracts when it gets really cold, and the tires actually freeze, so you end up with this flat bit at the bottom, and then when you get moving, and clunk, 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 clunk. That's dukkha. 40 below in northern Manitoba. That's dukkha. So then the Buddha is using something that's fairly ordinary, of course it's an emotional experience as well, the sense of discomfort, dis-ease. And the structure itself of how the Buddha used it as a contemplation was also that sense of dis-ease is also, he used a contemporary to his time medical model of the symptoms, the diagnosis of the cause. Okay, it's looking at, so here's the symptom of some particular disease or some physical ailment that's happening. Okay, and then there's the cause, and it's a kind of a diagnosis, and then there's the cessation of dukkha is the prognosis. Okay, this can be cured. And then there's the method of treatment, the path leading to cessation of suffering. So we're all carrying this dis-ease that we can treat ourselves, we can look after ourselves, we can be free from dukkha. I'd say the Buddha is giving us the tools to do that, and to through our own contemplation, investigation, understanding, but in that, he's also saying there is an appropriate way to relate to each of those truths. And this is really important in the sense of Again, if it becomes you want to have tools, and this is one of the things that sort of the very early days of my becoming interested in Buddhism, just that sense of confidence in the feeling that the Buddha just laid out all the tools on the table, and you know, basically all the cards are on the table here. You can, you've got things to work with. Go for it. And so that the, but then in order to, it's like relating to that experience of dukkha or discontent, dissatisfaction, was that the appropriate response that's needed is that it needs to be understood fully. We need to understand it. We need to be able to watch it, investigate it, experience it, consider it, because the tendency—it's like the response to the say the appropriate response, or the appropriate duty that we have to the cause of suffering. That is to be let go of. That is to be abandoned and to be done away with, and but our impulse and our it's like a innate response we want to get rid of dukkha. Mm-hmm. And it's, but as long as we haven't fully understood it, then we keep going back to it. The seeds of its renewal are always there, and so that we have to be willing to understand it, to investigate it, to recognize it. And of course, that's what those tools of the path, the Eightfold Path, are for, giving us the stability and clarity of mind to be able to understand, because. Yeah, I mean, who wants to suffer? You know. So, but as long as we're just reacting blindly or not having the correct tools and just getting out of it in some way, shape, or form without that full understanding, then it keeps coming back to haunt us, and that. So that. And this is something that Ajahn Chah, when he was teaching us, I mean, that emphasis on being patient, being willing to be patient. With patient with the process, but patient with the discomfort of the human condition of that quality of dukkha, and so being willing to there's a certain, and of course it comes with all sorts of other aspects, but this is something that I think for. Living in a modern era of instant gratification, then just being patient with something that's uncomfortable seems stupid. You know, why bother? I can get out of this. I don't want to deal with this. But it is important to recognize that patience is it's a translation of an Indian word from ancient times, and because patience, I think in for most of us, has that the impression of just. Putting up with something unpleasant, waiting for it to be over, and that doesn't really brighten the mind. But patience, is a or the say the word that's just kanti in the scriptural language. Kanti is seen as a transformative spiritual quality. It's called a barami. These are qualities which are aids in crossing over from confusion to clarity, from agitation to peace, from worldly entanglements to transcendent liberation. These are so it isn't just patient, put up with this and grumble and complain the whole time, begrudgingly putting up with something. But it's more like a being willing to be present with is more the quality of patience. Just that sense of being willing to be present with a, and then whether it's a pleasant or an unpleasant physical situation, pleasant, unpleasant, emotional state, we can, that willingness to be present starts to reveal things to us. We start to see more clearly what it is that, one, our own impulses are and our habits, as well as what the possibility of transcendence is. It isn't that we try to force our minds into freedom from dukkha, but it's recognizing that that's not the whole picture. There's a lot more going on, and peace and a kind of an unshakable quality of heart are a part of the picture if we were willing to open to it. And that the sense of openness to dukkha, our willingness to give the attention and have the patience to direct our attention to dukkha. And also in terms of dukkha as a concept, or suffering as a concept, and the Buddha articulates three particular aspects of dukkha, and saying so that there's dukkha that is, he says dukkha. It's the dukkha that the suffering that really is unpleasant or uncomfortable. That's what we do experience. We have some illness. We have some separation. It's unpleasant. It's unsatisfying. But then there's dukkha because of separation, and the viparinama dukkha, the dukkha of, and that's happiness. When we're separated from what we like, what we prefer, what we want, what we're delighted by, what we're happy about, and it's not that it's bad, or we have to stuff it down or push it away, but it's sort of recognizing that in the very nature of things, even something that is extremely pleasant, it will change, and the ability to recognize that as, and it's not to be a good Buddhist, you just have to throw a wet blanket on everything, because it's also that one has to learn how to cultivate happiness. It's like there's a discourse where the Buddha is still before his enlightenment, and he's already seen that his sort of austerities are really not the path, and he's trying to contemplate, well, what is the path? And then his mind goes back to a time when he was a young boy, young lad, and just sitting out under a tree, and the adults are off doing something else, and he's sitting there peacefully, and his mind became settled and concentrated. It was an experience of that settling, a samadhi experience, which is accompanied by extreme happiness. And then he said, and then that thought is, could this happiness be the path? And of course, the first reaction is because both in Indian tradition, or even in, say, like, especially, I mean, I think in Judeo-Christian tradition, there's a kind of guilt that comes with happiness, you know, in that sense, so you shouldn't really be that happy. But then the Buddha said, well, wait a minute, that happiness is completely without any harmful connotation. It's actually quite pure. And maybe that is the path. And then the contra, yes, this is the path. And this is the part. And so that cultivating, so that then when the Buddha speaks of like the benefits of, you know, in practice in different ways, then oftentimes he speaks of the happiness of living within a virtuous framework and living with integrity. There's a happiness that comes of realizing that one is living a completely blameless life, and there's a happiness that's there. Or the happiness that comes from association with good people. There's the happiness that comes from generosity and giving and sharing. And these are very tangible happinesses. And the happiness that comes from a peaceful mind. The happiness that comes from seeing truth without all of our filters complicating it. So these are aspects of happiness that are to be cultivated, but even when we experience it, it's also recognizing that we can't hold on to it and make it be there according to our preferences and wishes, and if we do that, that's a good way of experiencing the first noble truth. it'll be suffering not because of the happiness itself, but it's because of our clinging, our grasping, our expectation. And so that being able to separate those things out and seeing, yeah, this is dukkha, this is the way it works, this is the way dukkha is formed. The same thing, there's another aspect of dukkha that the Buddha points to, of just the dukkha of everything being of a compounded nature. And, you know, whether it's our physical body, the world around us, our emotional realm, our cognitive faculties, these are all come together because of causes and conditions, and they're always in a state of change. And so that when it's, and you know, oftentimes we don't see or recognize clearly all of the different elements that are there, and then we get kind of discombobulated because it's not following the way we think it should be or how we want it. So then just the fact of things being of a compounded constructed nature. They and just sort of thinking of a as a abbot of a monastery, just once you build a monastery, then you got to look after it. you got to, and it's the same if you've got a house, you've got a home. There's the constant maintenance and you realize that, well, then it's, our physical body and our own kind of emotional well-being. This is all of a constructed nature. So, yeah, it takes effort, and you have to be prepared for it to keep falling apart. So it's so seeing that, I mean, it's an aspect of dukkha. It's a sense of unsatisfactoriness. To have a completely satisfactory condition in the world is not possible. Which is a great belief to realize that, or to actually live one's life accordingly, because then you're not investing a whole lot of energy in trying to make something be what it can't possibly be. And then you start realizing, oh, well, where do I put my effort? Where do I put my attention? How do I support the things that give that sense of, the different kinds of happiness that the Buddha points to? Yeah, the happiness of integrity, the happiness of good friendships, the happiness of generosity, all the different forms of happiness that are available to us, and without trying to force any issue. So that sense of understanding dukkha, and then understanding that the cause of dukkha is the different kinds of desire and attachment. And I was mentioning yesterday of the when the Buddha says the cause of suffering is desire. It's a technical term. It's tanha. And it's desire that is always going to be bound up with greed, hatred, delusion, always bound up with attachment and clinging. And so it's going to be, it's going to end up feeling frustrated. And so that understanding that, recognizing, and then the duty to, or the appropriate response to that second noble truth of desire being the cause of suffering, is that's to be abandoned, to be let go of. That releasing itself, or that relinquishing, that letting go, is an opening into kind of a happiness and well-being itself. It's important to not spend, especially as practitioners, and most people here have been practicing for some time, not to spend all your time looking at dukkha. Pay attention to the cessation of dukkha. And it's something that, because it's not so tangible, then, we end up, cessation of dukkha, ending of dukkha. Well, dukkha's more familiar, I'll go back to that. But it's really important to get a very experiential feel for what is it like when there is a an ending, a ceasing of that feeling of dissatisfaction. Because if it were constant, then there's places where they take those people. In reality, we're not always, there is a ceasing of dukkha. There is a ceasing of that sense of discontent and dissatisfaction. But we tend to go on to the next thing, and then we miss it. So that giving attention to the ending, the ceasing, and also giving attention to the just the ending of things. You notice that even with your meditation, you're paying attention to the in breath and the out breath, and what will tend to attract your attention, or what your attention will be able to sustain itself on, is the beginning of the breath. And then when, especially as you start to get a bit calmer, and then the breath settles, and there's sits, and the breath, the in-breath ceases, and that'll be what there's kind of a gap there where we start to, okay, now what do I do? So we start looking for, the mind starts to go to its conceiving again. So then it's becoming very conscious of the endings of things. And it's, as an exercise or as a part of practice, it's really important. And so you start getting a feel for that and confidence in the fact that there is there is this possibility open to us all the time. It isn't as if, well, if I practice hard enough in the future and get my act together and somehow are blessed with good fortune, I'm going to experience a cessation of dukkha, sort of. But no, it's something that we integrating into a present moment practice, present moment awareness. And also the when the Buddha speaks of the cessation, the ending of dukkha, of suffering, of dis-ease, he points out to particular qualities of mind, of heart, that are integral to supporting that experience of cessation of dukkha. And the first is chako, chaka is like giving, but it has a connotation of giving up as well. So like many people who've been around Buddhist practice for a while, say dana is a word for giving. That tends to be giving more on a material level, but jhaka is also that, but then it also has a sense of, say, of giving away, giving up, and that giving away is really important. So we don't have to hang on to dukkha. We can give it away. If anybody else wants to pick it up, it's but it's just letting it go to cessation, letting it go to a place of its own ending. Chako patinisako is a sense of relinquishment, so which is also a sense of giving away. But it's that particular word that the Buddha uses is a more around the sense of self, sense of me, And because that's actually the glue that holds the that experience of dukkha together, a sense of identification. This is me. This is mine. This is who I am. There's a phrase that comes up over and over again that the Buddha uses for the a fundamental, say, difficulty in the human condition that keeps us returning to difficulty and dukkha. It's the I-making, mind-making, underlying tendency to conceit. And it's something that we do. It isn't something that is foisted upon us, or that is inevitable in the it's something that we do. So that I making we make this sense of this is who I am. This is really what defines me. Of course, what defines me keeps changing depending on our mood. And so it's something like a mirage that keeps moving into the distance. You can sort of see it seems real, but you keep keeps just over there, so it doesn't have a real solidity to it. And the same with that mind making sense of this is mine. Desire to claim possession over anything, whether it's material or emotional, of ourselves, of others. Well, however, that sense of mine. And the underlying tendency to conceit is interesting in, because the word conceit in English tends to be conceit in sort of feeling yourself, say, better than others or looking down on others. Whereas from the Buddha's perspective, he said there's 9 bases of conceit. It's like being inferior and thinking oneself inferior, being inferior and thinking oneself equal, being inferior and thinking one superior, being equal, thinking oneself, you see where this is going. being inferior and thinking, because some things we're just not as good at. So being inferior. Assuming oneself equal, it's our being equal, thinking oneself inferior, being equal, thinking oneself equal, because even that, just as good. And even if it's true, it's still a position. And thinking oneself, and then even to being superior, being better at something. Thinking oneself inferior, thinking oneself equal, or thinking oneself superior. Because it's as long as we take a position of something, then we prop up our sense of dukkha, because that's always going to change, and it's constructed, and so it's the sense of comparing. We compare ourselves to others all the time, and that limits us to. Here you think in terms of like one of the divine abidings, and see the like loving kindness, compassion. One of the divine abidings is a sympathetic joy, And so that if we're, say, obsessed with ourselves and trying to figure out what position we're at, who, you know, how do we rank according, it kind of hinders us from the possibility of experiencing that kind of joy at the well-being or accomplishment, success of others. And that's a that's a limitation to our happiness. And that's I think it was His Holiness the Dalai Lama sort of saying, you know, this is really the best kind of joy because you don't even have to do anything. You can just see somebody else be successful. And just, oh, you can delight in that. that letting go of self. Mutti is to, again, this letting go or putting down. It literally means freedom, but it's like freedom from a burden. We carry the burden of our perceptions, of our memories, of our expectations, of our, you know, projections, you know, on and on. Those are burdens that we carry. So being able to put them down and not pick them back up again, which is the tough bit. But that's in terms of practice. It's a really interesting practice to, you know, that cessation of suffering, putting down a feeling or a memory or something, and then watching what happens. It's like, we do put it down, and, you know, can I keep putting it down, or can I not go back and try to pick it up? It's just an interesting investigation, and plugs us into that cessation of suffering, cessation of dukkha. And the last one, Analio, which is kind of like translated like as non-identification sometimes, or just not identifying with. But it also it's in the scriptural language, it has a connotation of non-stickiness. It's like when the mind doesn't stick to a particular mood or position that one takes, or whatever feeling, and so that sense of non-identification is not a sort of a shunning or pushing away. It's just like that doesn't stick, slides off, sort of the Teflon coating of the mind, you know, which is great. And because it opens the mind up, or opens the heart up to not getting cluttered with our own moods, impressions, whatnot. Which, of course, leaves the mind with a clarity and stability that's really able to see things in their true nature. And that's what takes us, again, is this path of practice that the Buddha gives, that prescribes the appropriate response or duty to the cessation of suffering. It is to be realized. So again, the sense of paying attention, being willing to realize, experience that, and, you know, whether it's in a, you know, however momentary or however one experiences that realizing and so taking it in. The last noble truth is the path of practice leading to the cessation. So Eightfold Path, or like I said, the three trainings I talked about yesterday of virtue, of meditation, of wisdom. Those are to be cultivated. Those are to be developed. The right view, right Right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right meditation. Those are to be cultivated. Those are to be developed, and that's what starts to allow us to get a glimpse of the nature of the possibility of real peace and liberation, real understanding, and that it keeps leading. As I said, yesterday I mentioned it, like one of the qualities that the Buddha points to as a quality of the Dhamma, it's leading inwards, drawing it in, drawing it into the heart, drawing it into our experience, and letting it resonate there. That quality of allowing that to keep coming in. So all of the practice is coming into the heart. Like Ajahn Chah gives an image of like when you, a lot of his images are from countryside. That's where he grew up in. But then when you make charcoal, you make kind of an oven, and then you make a fire outside of the oven. You know, kind of light the fire inside. You light the fire outside, and then you've got little air holes that you send it, and it draws the heat in to the oven, and then you have to monitor it, and then you start closing up the air holes, so the heat stays in that kind of oven, and then it turns the wood to charcoal, and that transformation. So that's like the Eightfold Path. He said that all of our practice, it's drawn into the heart, and it changes us, it transforms us. So that to be, you know, paying attention to those qualities, and you know, on a certain level, we can, you know, like I've been talking for almost an hour, and it sounds like a lot, like a lot of information, a lot of things to do, but it isn't. In the end, it's just what the things that nurture the ability to know clearly, you know, this fundamental awareness that we already have. By virtue of being born as a human being, we have a foundation of being able to know things clearly. But then it tends to keep going out and get distracted, or if it's turned in, it's sort of in this kind of jumble inside sometimes. So that learning how to settle and allow the heart to really clarify. And there's a Thai teacher who expresses it very beautifully, she lived, she probably passed away about 30, 40 years ago, but she put it, an inward staying, unentangled knowing, all outward going knowing cast aside. Just incredibly simple, very beautiful. An inward staying, unentangled knowing, all outward going knowing cast aside. And it's just this is a possibility that we have each moment. And the things that we do, all the practices that we're involved in, our life as we live it, those all have the possibility of being drawn into the heart and nurturing that unentangled knowing, that to be able to attend to that, experience it, recognize its possibility for our transformation. So I'll offer that for reflection this morning. And we could have a period of walking meditation. And then similarly, as we're doing walking meditation, lifting up that quality of knowing. Just knowing the sensation, knowing the movement of mind, knowing the reactions that come up, and just knowing and letting go. And that's actually what Ajahn Chah once said. I said, this path, the practice of the Buddhas, it's not difficult. It's really easy. It's only two things you need to do. Know and let go. you keep coming back to the knowing, keep allowing that letting go to happen, and that's that opens things. And so just to experiment with that, with an experiment and relaxing into the walking, and that attentiveness, alertness, just to the simplicity of movement and touch, so we can have a period of walking meditation.